this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for the March 3rd meeting.
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the minutes from March 3rd.
Representative Lee moves approval of the March 3rd minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. First bill on the agenda is House File 3580. And this is going to the Education Finance Division. So I will move House File 3580 be referred to the Education Finance Division. Jerry Joachim, would you like to present your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for having House File 3590 before your committee. This bill is brought to us by the Professional Educators Licensing Standards Board. It has already been heard in Education Policy Committee and is before you on the rulemaking provisions on 6.16 and lines 7.17 to 7.22. A little background. In 2017, the legislature passed legislation combining the services provided by the Board of Teaching and the Minnesota Department of Education Educators Licensing Division into one entity, the Professional Educator Licensing Standards Board that we lovingly call PELSB in the education realm. This board is now charged with licensing all the teachers in the state. PELSB has been functioning in this new structure for almost 2 years now, and while with all newer things, sometimes they need a few tweaks after they've been running for a while. So you'll see those practical changes reflected in House File 3580 before you today. I have Alex Luizzi, the Executive Director of PELSB, here to walk you through those sections if you'd like, or we can just have him here for technical questions.
Do members have a preference? If nobody has any strong feelings, I think maybe he can just come up for questions. I understand in addition to the rulemaking provisions, Section 18 dealing with transfer of powers, lines 9.2 to 9.4 is also within the jurisdiction of this committee. So is there anyone who would like to testify on House File 3580? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Okay, that's pretty straightforward. Chair Joachim, any closing remarks?
No, members, thank you. Thank you for having this bill before you. I think the goal, we all share the same goal of having highly qualified and licensed teachers in our classroom, and PELSB helps make that happen. This bill will make sure that they have the tools that they need to do that. So I ask for your support in sending this bill to Education Finance.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3580 be referred to the Education Finance Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is Representative Cleaborn here?
No, she's not.
Okay, I understand she was, okay. Representative Mason, would you like to, are you ready to present your bill?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So, and this is going to the General Register. Would you like to move, Representative Mason, would you like to move House File 2058 be referred to the General Register?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I will move House File 2058 to the General Register.
Okay. Representative Mason moves her bill. Would you care to present your bill?
This is a fairly simple bill where it just makes a slight adjustment to the condemnation proceedings, and I will let my testifier from MnDOT do the details.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Morning, Chair, members. My name is Jennifer Witt, and I'm with MnDOT. This bill seeks to make minor technical changes to the statutes related to condemnation commissioners. These changes are being asked for because two determinations by the courts were made, and the first determination was that a commissioner does not need to be a Minnesota resident. Since these commissioners are being appointed to determine the land value and then compensation for that land, we ask that the language change require that the commissioners are from Minnesota so that they have a good understanding of Minnesota real estate values and the compensation that would be appropriate. The second court determination the bill seeks to address is a requirement to have the prospective commissioner show up personally in court to say that they don't have a conflict of interest in any proceeding. And before the court made that determination, the process used to be that a commissioner would sign an affidavit stating that they didn't have any conflict of interest in the case that they were going to be appointed to. And so we'd like to, it to go back to that. And so that's what this language would do.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 2058? Seeing none, member discussion. Ranking Member Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is somewhat related. And I, the testifier, a few years ago, there was a ruling that upheld aggregation of multiple parcels in a federal situation, would you be available for meeting offline? So I could become more familiar with the condemnation and some of the differences between our current setup and what the federal government is working under.
Chair?
Please respond.
Representative Quam, Chair. Yes, of course we would. I'm not exactly sure what that is, but yes, we would be happy to try to figure out and help you with any information we can provide.
Thank you.
And I think Representative Quam has a bill to address. So
that's that would address that, but the we were running quick, and it's nice we get opportunity in committee to meet some of the experts that we have in the state, and thank you for your indulgence in letting me ask for a meeting.
Yeah, Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question, maybe somewhat unrelated to this specifically, but during the process of acquiring right-of-way and when it comes to a business or maybe a residence, what recourse does the business owner or the maybe homeowner have if they feel like that their valuation is too low?
Ms. Witt.
Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. I'm going to call on my lifeline from land management to answer that.
Welcome to the committee. Just please identify yourself, and then you can respond to the question.
Mr. Chair, my name is Joe Pignato. I'm the Director of Land Management for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. Representative, I if I heard your question correctly, you're asking about what do property owners have in recourse of our appraisals?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We offer within statute also, we offer the homeowner or property owner the ability to go out and get their own appraisal. And from there, we will reimburse them. And in statute, it talks about how much reimbursement. It's like $1,500 for residential and $5,000 for commercial property. And then from there, we'll sit down and we will negotiate. Based off of that in good faith as required by statute.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer, and I appreciate that. I'm wondering also, is it a part of the calculus whether or not for a business that maybe considers their location and ongoing business, maybe 10 years down the road they can continue to expand or something like that. Is it kind of a stagnant evaluation, I guess, is my question, or is there any room for, making an argument that there's an expanded level of value over time, maybe that's not apparent at the very moment that you're assessing it?
Mr. Pignato.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not an appraiser. I'm an engineer, but my understanding of the appraisal process is that we establish a data take. And from there, we will take a look at what the property values are. And then there's another thing called severance damage that the appraisers will take a look at. And they'll walk through and they will look at those types of situations where if there is an expansion plan that has been established by the data take by that company, they'll take a look at that and they'll do some calculations based off of that damage to that remaining property. It's different than going and just buying your house. I mean, it's easy. We know that's what most of us are generally used to, is going out and purchasing a home. It's a total take. You're taking the full property. What we're trying to do is what's called a before and after appraisal, and that's what the appraisers look at. They look at the property at the data take, what it's worth before, and then they look at it as an after we take that property, and it does take into account those types of expansions if at the data take the property had been identified to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just a kind of an obvious question. Generally, when you have a bill like this that makes little changes, you're trying to solve a problem. So I guess my question is, have there ever been a non-Minnesota resident serving as commissioner, or what's happened in the past that led to this change?
Ms. Witt.
Chair, Representative, I don't know if there's been a non-Minnesota resident serving as a commissioner, but I do know that there was a determination by a judge that said that a commissioner does not have to be a resident of Minnesota. And we just feel like the commissioner should know our real estate value, how we value land, have that knowledge, and that's just worked for us, and so we'd like it to be that way. We just think that's important.
Representative Lehman.
Okay. So something was brought to court. Somebody was challenging their ability to be a commissioner.
Chair, Representative, it wasn't a case. It was a determination by a judge. And so, yes, we're just trying to make sure that we clarify that seems to be a better route to go.
Okay. Seems reasonable. Thank you.
Any additional member discussion? Okay. Any closing remarks, Representative Mason?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to renew my motion to move House File 2058 to the General Register. I'd appreciate your support.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Mason renews her motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you,
Representative Mason. Representative Cleavorn, you have House File 3957. I will move that House File 3957 be referred to the General Register. When you are ready, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I am here with Shanti Shaw, and she will be doing the bulk of the presentation this morning. But I am asking, as a representative from one of the largest India American communities, Plymouth, and also for our community nearby, Maple Grove, that you would please give this bill consideration to acknowledge August 15th of each year as India Day to celebrate the India culture in Minnesota and to help all of our community members to feel welcomed and appreciated in the great state of Minnesota. With that, Mr. Chair, I would ask that you recognize Shanti Shaw.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Shanti Shaw, and I'm the Chair of Government Relations and Civic Engagement for India Association of Minnesota, an organization that has been in place since 1972. Having said that, I'm here to request your support for this bill, House File 3957, to establish August 15th each year to be designated India Day to commemorate India's independence. This day is for Minnesota Indian American to celebrate our heritage, culture, and contribution to Minnesota. Indian Americans in Minnesota celebrate this day at the state capitol each year by welcoming all Minnesotans to share their culture, tradition, and values. With nearly 50,000 people, Indian American community is the second largest Asian community in Minnesota. According to 2014 census data, updated census data, 81% have a bachelor or higher degree, an average household income, $89,000, and nearly 50% home ownership. I wanted to demonstrate its economic contribution to Minnesota. Indian Americans have contributed significantly in all walks of life. We are educators, innovators, scientists, physicians, business owners, and not to mention technologists. The community is also enriched, has enriched Minnesota's cultural landscape in art, music, dance, theater, and cuisine. Our rich heritage also includes many houses of worship, which serves Indians who are practicing Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, Sikhism, and Jainism. Nearly 20 different languages are spoken by people from many Indian states. This rich and colorful Indian heritage celebrates it here every year on state capitol each year on August 15th, or around August 15th, I should say. This year, by the way, it is going to be on August 15th. India Association of Minnesota has celebrated India Day since 1974 at various locations in the Twin Cities. As the community grew, we needed larger space, which includes our state capital. For almost a decade, we have been celebrating at the state capital. India Fest showcases the arts and cultural contribution of our community and features over 160 Indian American artists. Many are professionals. This free annual gathering showcases the diverse community of Indian Americans in Minnesota and brings together almost 12,000 Indians, as well as we continue to welcome many more non-Indians to this event. A declaration of August 15th as India Day recognizes the continuing contribution of this vibrant community. We urge you to support this bill declaring India Day and vote for House File 3957. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Shah. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on House File 3957? Seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Representative Gomez, then Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Cleburne, for bringing this forward. And to Ms. Shah, I really appreciate you being here. You know, obviously, Indian American people have made incredible contributions to our state and continue to do so, and so I'm supportive of this. But I feel like I can't let this moment pass without talking a little bit about what's happening in India right now. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a number of friends who are Muslims from the subcontinent, yeah. And it's a very scary time for Muslim people in India at this moment. You know, what I think have been characterized as riots that have resulted, you know, because of a law that was implemented by the government in India, there's an increase in kind of what in South Asia you call communal violence, right? Like, so kind of between people of different identities, and in this case it's about religion. And you know what we've seen very recently, just in the last couple weeks, something that I first saw reported in the media as riots that resulted in the death of Muslim people. I've seen scholars of ethnic conflict start to refer to as pogroms, because what we see is the apparatus of the state intervening in an inter-religious, in this case, conflict on one side. And in this case, it's on the side of Hindus, and the government is controlled by a Hindu nationalist party. So I guess I just want to express, you know, that I know that what's happening there doesn't reflect the will of a vast, overwhelming majority of people there, of Indian people, of Indian American people, but just to express my solidarity with people on all sides in this time that it feels very painful, even from an outside perspective. Mm-hmm. So again, that's not to detract from this, from what you're doing here, but I just didn't want to let the moment pass without acknowledging what I think is a very dangerous moment for us as human beings. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gomez.
Mr. Chair, may I address?
Sure, Representative Cleaborn.
Representative Gomez, I couldn't agree with you more. And it is something that Ms. Shaw and I have discussed at great length. We, in Plymouth, as you may or may not know, we have a mosque, and our Plymouth community is very diverse, and the India community within Plymouth is extremely diverse. And the thing that I would celebrate about this bill is it's not about one of the cultural heritage entities over another. This is about unifying Minnesotans around their heritage prior to coming to Minnesota, and to uplift all groups in the Indian community, not just one sect or another. And to bring it as a way of getting Minnesotans to unify and to honor whichever, whether they be Hindu or Sikh or Muslim, it doesn't matter. This is a way for each group to be able to have a booth and to bring forth their beliefs, their foods, their dress, their cultural heritage, and unite around being one Minnesota. And for us as a state to not say that we are standing with one or another, but that we honor all. And my big concern is with the things that are happening as you're speaking, is how do I keep Plymouth unified, and to make sure that we uplift every person in our state, and that would be my goal and intention with this bill. Thank you.
May I answer your question?
Ms. Shaw. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, proceed.
India is about 70-year-old democracy, and it is an extremely complex country. It's not one monolith, and has always been very complex. And it is a democracy that we are proud of. The challenge will continue every time ethnic related, often religious related events, and they have been part of its democracy growing and maturing. What is really, it's very distressful for me sitting here, and when I see some of those events happening. But I have a lot of faith in the democracy working, in its working it out. And at the end of the day, with having second largest Muslim community in India, it cannot afford to have this kind of ongoing. And what's amazing is you have multiple linguistic and cultural groups believing in the same flag itself is a huge, huge, and from my perspective, success for this country. Mm-hmm. So yes, it is having a lot of growing pains, but it also has a very supportive community within it. So don't, looking from here, all we can see is the news that come to us. We are not looking at the total picture, and we are hoping India Fest allows us to provide that to everybody. It doesn't reduce our pain, but that is how we are learning every time.
Thank you, Ms. Shaw. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my communities of Egan and Burnsville, we have a huge population of people from India, and it's just amazing how many people have moved here and the benefit to our society. And I did want to mention, a couple of years ago, the Historical Society had a very special exhibit about Indian immigration, and I'm thinking there's probably still pieces of that over there to look at. Thank you.
That was 2015, Beyond Bollywood. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
It's okay.
I'm new to this.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Okay, sure. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering if staff could let us know what other similar existing state days there might be?
Sure. Good question, Representative Quam. Just maybe give him a second.
Right. And while he's looking that up, because, you know, coming to mind is Cinco de Mayo. There is Norway's independence from Sweden, Canada's independence, even though there's still a Commonwealth. And the large portions of our state that have ancestry in different countries. Mm-hmm. And so I was just curious what past history of declaring one day or another
sure.
we have in statute.
I suspect he is looking for chapters of the Minnesota statutes adjacent to section 10.551. Looks like he's found some.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I can just read to you the titles of the days that exist in Chapter 10 that seem to relate to sort of nationalities and ethnic heritage. So we have Ethnic American Day on the first Sunday in June. Juneteenth is the third Saturday in June. Cesar Chavez Day is March 31st. And then there are several other days that are that recognize military accomplishments and other types of events like that.
Yeah. Representative Paul?
Thank you. So in past history, we have days designated for, I assume Cuba was Cesar Chavez. Is that a correct?
No.
Enlighten me, please. And that's part of why we're here to discuss, is to find out why we have designated some of the days.
Sure. Mr. Gehring, could you maybe just read the description next to Cesar Chavez Day?
Mr. Chair, so Cesar Chavez Day is, according to the statute, intended to celebrate the growing Latino community in Minnesota and recognizes them as a major demographic community within the state.
Okay, so yeah, that isn't a National Independence Day that's being celebrated then? So
it's recognition of a community within Minnesota.
Okay, so I'm trying to understand, because this year's specifically picking a day to celebrate for a country, and I know that we have lots of celebrations. There are Greek festivals, there are Norwegian celebrations for their day where they came and got separated from Sweden. Canada Day, et cetera. And so I just am trying to understand, because I appreciate and we should celebrate, and I know that we do, many communities celebrate. Mm-hmm. However, making it a state day, I'm just trying to understand, and I didn't hear a precedent that there was. Is there a National Independence Day for any other nation at this time?
Representative Quam, it sounds like there may not be. I mean, I read this to, it does fall on the National Independence Day. That seems like a logical selection of a day to me, but it does, ultimately it says it's to appreciate the Indian American community and their contributions to Minnesota. It looks like Representative Cleavorn might have something to follow up with on that.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, when I heard Mr. Gehring speak, what he said is it is to, under the Cesar Chavez, what he said is it is to acknowledge the growing community within the state. The Indian Association of Minnesota is a 50-year-old institution, and they have not previously come to ask for this designation. They have asked yearly for proclamations. Now, because they are more than 50,000 strong in their membership, they are just asking for the state to recognize the culture, the heritage of their community within our state, and also as a way to acknowledge the tremendous economic development that they bring to our states. When Ms. Shaw testified, she spoke about the fact that many of them in the community have terminal degrees. They are our doctors, our lawyers, our engineers, our professors. They bring tremendous wealth in, and also they serve as ambassadors for our state to bring more industry to our state. And it's just a way to honor that contribution and to say, yes, this is an important and vibrant part of our state.
Representative Quam?
When I was in Texas, Cinco de Mayo was a big celebration. Mm-hmm. And I would think that that would be a large population in the state. Mm-hmm. And it's not celebrating a person, but mm-hmm. A people. And the same with, we have the celebrations for Norwegian independence, and we have others. And I think it'd be nice to have, a similar type thing, looking at all of the major components of the state, because we are an extremely diverse state. Mm-hmm. And it should be independent of, well, this group, they're highly educated and they're bringing us great wealth and investment. But in our ag industry, there are many people that have immigrated from our neighboring countries mm-hmm. to make our ag industry strong. And they might not have a doctoral degree, but they keep our thriving communities in greater Minnesota going. And decreasing of the intent or the appropriateness. It's just that if we're looking at this and we're going to do the first national-based holiday-type thing by the state, that maybe we look at being more inclusive of the diverse and vigorous, heritage of the people that contribute to making our state what it is. And that's what I was trying to pull out, because it is national as opposed to a person, and it is to the independence, which is a very key thing within that country.
Representative Quam, if you'd like to introduce a bill designating Cinco de Mayo or Norwegian Independence Day, I would be glad to consider it in this committee. Representative Claiborne.
Ms. Shaw would like to address the committee, please.
Oh, sure, Ms. Shaw.
Representative and Chair, if we try to do every holidays in India with as much diversity we have, we may run out of 365 days. So this is probably the best way for us to provide our unity, kind of represent our unity. It's the independence that unites us, not our religion, not our other holidays. And if you just look at the calendar that Hindu Mandir publishes, you'll see something every day. Mm-hmm. So we could not afford to request 365 requests like this. Sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shaw.
And Mr. Chair, I'm trying to limit the number of bills I introduce each week, so I will keep it under consideration.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Claiborne. Thank you, Ms. Shaw, for being here today. You may know, of course, it's quite apparent that I am a co-author on this bill. And obviously, I have lived and worked in and amongst this community for literally decades. Some of the folks in this community are among my best and closest friends. And I know there's also a lot of overlap between the Indian community and the Guyanese community as well, where there's a lot of folks who have formed close friendships and that heritage unites them across barriers. And in fact, many folks do not know that the city of Maple Grove is the home to the largest mandir in the state, the largest temple in the state. And they are fantastic neighbors, incidentally. I also want to acknowledge for Representative Quam that I do know that a great many of us celebrate things like Swedish midsommar, the winter solstice. We may have festivals centered around Lucia and all of those things to celebrate ours, as I know I do, as a proud Gustavus graduate, a Swede and a Norwegian. But I think that that does not certainly detract from the ability for us to recognize that there is a growing and vibrant community amongst us that does incredible things in building community,
doing community service work, building relationships between neighbors and friends. And I am really proud and honored to be on this bill. I thank you for bringing it forward. And in terms of the date, I know that while we are not necessarily here to represent the Independence Day, we are here to celebrate the people. However, as Ms. Shaw mentioned, this is a perfect, if you have to choose a date to unify folks, this is an excellent date to choose. And so it just makes sense from that perspective. With that, I actually do not have any questions for the author, but more just a comment and a thank you for bringing this bill forward and acknowledging this incredible community. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Lehman.
I'll pass.
Okay. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Shaw, and Representative Cleveland for bringing this over, too. And I think what's really great about this bill is that, you know, we're giving the opportunity for the rest of Minnesota to really learn about a rich and diverse community. And I think that us having this discussion is really needed. You know, when we're elected officials and we, you know, we acknowledge that throughout the state of Minnesota there are diverse communities, I think that, you know, that shows a lot to our many community members regardless of where they're from. And so I really appreciate that. And I think that, you know, as a state, we should, you know, really look into what can we do so that all of our constituents, regardless of their background, understand the differences from the different communities. And, you know, oftentimes when we hear these discussions, people often think that, you know, Asian Indians are, you know, our indigenous community members, and they're not. They're, you know, two different communities. And so bringing this forward really acknowledge that, you know, we do have different cultures and heritage in the state of Minnesota. And so really want to say thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Gomez?
Just quickly, and hopefully my mentioning his name doesn't mean he automatically has to respond, but just if Representative Quam is going to bring forward a bill on this, I just wanted to note for everybody that Cinco de Mayo is not Mexican Independence Day. It's a commemoration of the battle at Puebla, which was where the Mexican army defeated a French army that was twice their size. The commemoration of Mexican independence from Spain is celebrated on the 16th of September each year and is in Mexico certainly a much bigger holiday. And if you come to my neighborhood on the 16th of September, there's always a huge party in the streets. So please come to Lake Street that weekend, the Saturday closest to the 16th of September. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. I will be there.
All right.
Is there any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Cleaver?
I would just like to thank the committee for hearing 3957, and I would ask for your support in moving this bill to the general register. Thank you.
Thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 3957 be referred to the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to hand the gavel over to Representative Sauk. Bear with me here. So, Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 3957 be referred to the State Government Finance Division, and I also have an amendment. So I will move the A2 amendment, which is mostly technical changes, and we'll put the bill in the shape I would like.
All those in favor of the amendment that puts the bill in the shape the author desires, say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, your bill is now amended. Please go ahead and describe the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This morning I present to you House File 2509, which is designed to establish a Minnesota Volunteerism Innovation Board. We're currently in the midst of rapidly changing times with both pressing challenges and current and yet to be discovered opportunities that call for us to think strategically about how to maximize the contributions of Minnesota's volunteers for the greatest possible results. Historically, volunteers have been innovators, risk takers, and thought leaders who have played a vital role in creating Minnesota's success and high quality of life. Minnesota has long been renowned for our spirit of volunteerism. Yet we're not maximizing the potential of volunteer contributions aligned with key Minnesota areas of need and local and regional priorities. A close look at available data and research about where Minnesota can improve or has the opportunity to grow and succeed is needed. We must work intentionally for volunteer impact and results. Environmental changes appear to be impacting where volunteers go and how long they stay. For example, the rise in natural disasters may be calling people away from areas of essential volunteer service. Fears about the coronavirus may exacerbate shifts in where volunteers will want to serve and for how long. The opportunity gap cries out for sustained volunteering and to address the need for much more diversity, equity, and inclusion in our volunteer community. Increased engagement through social media is changing the nature of volunteer recruitment and support. Sustained volunteering has been declining. Resources have shifted away from volunteer-related activities such as service learning. All of these forms of community engagement are needed. A relatively modest investment in a volunteerism innovation board that includes grant making according to established criteria, when well implemented, will take us a long way and help us to make inroads in our efforts to address priorities throughout Minnesota. This investment in volunteers will be repaid many times through volunteer contributions and the results of volunteer actions. Passage of this bill will signal the importance of volunteerism and raise the stature and visibility of high quality, sustained volunteerism and volunteers. Let's strengthen and empower this most valuable resource. I have with me Ms. Paula Bugin, who can speak a little bit more about the importance of this bill as well.
Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present to you this morning. My name is Paula Bugin. I have been an active leader in paid and unpaid roles in the volunteer community in the areas of volunteerism and volunteer resources leadership for more than four decades, and have been involved in various sectors of the volunteer community. I'm going to keep my comments fairly brief, but try to make some key points. We need to take a hard look at the comprehensive volunteer community. We need to better understand how we can get to results through volunteerism in a way that's very strategic. And there are so many wonderful things going on. We have wonderful professional association. We have informal leaders in the volunteer community, formal leaders in the volunteer community, paid and unpaid. I'm going to read to you a few headlines recently that have appeared. There have been a number of them, but I'll just share like three of them or so. One of them, headline in a publication by Independent Sector that was on the web, written by Jan Masaoka, I hope I'm pronouncing her name properly, who is the director at the California Council of Nonprofits, wrote an article entitled "Bees and Volunteers, Both Need Our Attention Now." That was November 22nd, 2019. Also published by Independent Sector, some research by three researchers, Nathan Dietz, Robert Grimm, and Caitlin Ahmad, was an article headlined, "Philanthropy's Future is in Flux and Volunteering and Giving Rates Waver." These particular researchers have had several articles and have really pointed out the decline in we have had a high rate of volunteerism. As a matter of fact, it's been pointed out that the last report, we had 77.34 million volunteers in this country. They're donating billions of hours. In Minnesota, I have the number here, I think it's 1.9 million volunteers. But the intensity and the sustainability of the volunteering is not as great as it has been historically, while our needs, as always happens, are continuing to escalate. And then there was another article, September 11th, 2019, "Why Americans Stopped Volunteering" by Linda Poole and CityLab. I could be here for 5 days, so I just want you to get the gist of where some of the thinking is behind this. According to Minnesota Compass, which is housed at Wilder Foundation, there is a quote from some of their material. Minnesota has the second highest rate of volunteerism in the nation, but the share of adults who volunteer in the total volunteer hours have been slipping since 2010. And I will say that since 2008, I've been very focused on, along with other people, on some of these issues and how things are developing. Right now we have a report that's about to come out from the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service that is going to make some recommendations about national service and about the potential for universal national service. One of the things we need to better understand, and I am a supporter of national service, but we do need to look at how we are allocating our resources, which have shifted a great deal in more recent years or decades, away from the sustained non-stipend volunteering, while national service has been growing and growing. All of the parts of our volunteer community are so very important and provide unique dimensions and contributions to our society. I think that is all I really need to say about that. I'm happy to answer questions or whatever, Mr. Chair, that you would prefer to do.
Is there anyone else that plans to testify on the bill? If not, we'll go to committee comments and questions. Representative Kegel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I feel like I should maybe go up to the rostrum and testify on behalf of this one. In my past life, I was a professional volunteer coordinator. And so just kind of want to add on to some of the points that you hit. The value of a volunteer dollar is in Minnesota is $25.43. 46% of Minnesotans actually volunteer, and I think I saw an article recently where we are back on top in volunteerism, so hopefully that's the case. I was looking quickly at the DNR website, and the DNR just alone in Minnesota had over 283,000 hours of volunteerism, and that is an equivalent to 136 full-time employees. And just in firearm safety alone, there was 3,728 people who volunteered for 74,000 hours. So, you know, that's a big value to our state. And this is becoming a increasingly professionalized field. There are organizations, national organizations, that now certify organizations as service enterprise organizations. So, you know, when you go to a nonprofit and you see that stamp that says this is a, I can't remember what it is, but it's a stamp that says this is a good organization to donate to, a good place to put your money. There's now a certification for volunteerism that basically says this is an organization that will use your time and skills wisely. And so, you know, and also a lot of corporations are now seeing the value of volunteerism. Blue Cross Blue Shield allows their employees 20 paid hours per year to go and volunteer. And so, you know, as a volunteer coordinator, I worked with Target, Olympus, Thrivent. Finnegan's even has a reverse food truck that you can take a food truck to specific locations and or to any location, really, and have people donate food to you so that you can collect for people in need. And we used to have an office of volunteerism here in the state of Minnesota, and that was a executive order from Wendell Anderson in June 30th, 1975. And so this is really just taking us back to where we were, and volunteerism adds a ton of value to our state. And so I think this is a really good idea.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will echo some of those sentiments. I have volunteered at over two dozen schools and was a founding member of a corporate effort that established a mentoring program to middle schools from more of an engineering science type background to promote STEM before it became a STEM thing. I was curious because I heard paid and unpaid volunteers, and it seems a little odd. I can understand compensated or reimbursed volunteers. And, I look at local government, and there were a lot of senior citizens that wanted to volunteer and get involved. There were some obstacles to them being able to do so because it violated, like a negotiated contract about effort. And I know that there are Eagle Scouts that they have to do something for the community, a project, and that I have heard of a few examples also of where some regulation or something in a negotiated contract prevented a city or an entity from allowing them to do some activity. Is there any thought about looking at making volunteering not an issue? That sort of gray area between, because you're doing work for the community, and a lot of times you're augmenting, but we've got employees that are being paid to do that have a negotiated contract. So, I'm just curious on that topic because I'd like it easier for somebody that retires to come back and give back.
Well, one of the reasons we needed to have this bill pass is that we need to have conversations about a whole range of topics, and that may be one of them as we look at capacity and the need and where we focus. But I refer to myself as both in paid and unpaid roles. I do a ton of volunteering in many different ways. Historically, I was the leader of a volunteer program in a school district where I was an employee to set up the first district-wide volunteer program for that school district. And we worked very hard on a number of issues. For example, labor-volunteer relations were really, really important that we had a good relationship, and we did have a good relationship because we were working according to best practices, and we made it a priority to figure out how we do things. We also have programs like AmeriCorps, where there are certain rules about not being able to, I have worked with AmeriCorps members as a leader of a volunteer program, but there are rules that indicate that AmeriCorps members who do receive a stipend they supplement and do not supplant staff services. So they're not considered staff. But there are so many issues here. That's why we need to get into deeper conversation and have strategic grant-making process. I don't know if that's helpful. It's a big topic with so many dimensions to the answer.
Representative Quam, any other comments or questions related to your line of thought?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted you to touch on that. I understood that there is some compensation, but anyone that was listening, paid and unpaid volunteers, and I did want to give the one example of a project for beautification of an area along a street, a roadway, and they wanted to plant some, they wanted to do some things, and the Public Works Department said, well, you can't do that because that is underneath our scope. And I'd love to help facilitate conversations to make it easier for people that want to give back and make their community better to do so. So thank you.
I did not hear a question there. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many years ago, I did work as a volunteer coordinator, and it was when the state had a volunteer department, and I remember the director was housed in the Ford building.
Yes. Excuse me, I worked for the state office for probably 11 years or so.
So that was pretty
which
cool.
was then.
And I mean, we still have an incredible amount of volunteers and within our community. Where I see the biggest drop is in our churches and schools. I mean, our church, they no longer have a bazaar anymore because the people that were the mainstay are now getting too old. And I think because of the pressure we put on our younger families, they, you know, the parents just don't have a lot of extra time to be doing things. And the same thing within our schools, where we know that, you know, some schools have a real difficult time with PTA attendance, et cetera. So it's, those are things that I think we really need to keep in mind as we're going forward, is we're making it very difficult for, as I said, particularly young families to be able to participate.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I respond?
Yep.
This bill is focusing primarily on non-stipend volunteers. It doesn't exclude that, but that's not the primary focus, because that's where it's been missing. In response to the other question, comment that came up about us being, we're back up high, we're number two as of the last report that was released on how states are doing in volunteerism, but that was for the rate of volunteering. If you look historically, at volunteering, even though we're number two and even though we look really good nationally, if you look at what our numbers were like in terms of the hours and in terms of the dollar value, which has gone up, but our dollar value has gone down, it tells us a lot that we have been neglecting this area. So I'm not convinced that we are losing volunteers because they're not interested in sustained service. I think we are not taking all the steps we need to. But one last thing, and then I know we need to probably conclude, but I wanted to point out that this bill focuses on looking at grants that are focused around very intentional service that correspond to either the Minnesota Compass indicators, which is through Wilder Foundation. They have this whole process on where how we're doing in different areas as a state, for example, how many, it might be how much volunteering is going on, but it might be how we're doing with the opportunity gap, or it might be a whole number of areas that are where we want to get to as a state, but based on being driven locally and identified locally and regionally around the state, so that the money is going where the communities feel that it's needed best, but we have some metric to compare. We might not be able to know that that specific activity is affecting the overall goal, but we might be able to measure in relationship to that goal what progress we're making with the work that we're doing. So we want to have a way to get to results. And if it's not Minnesota Compass, if for some reason they didn't exist down the line, there's a something in here to correspond with the state demographer. Thank you for your allowing.
Representative Mason, anything further?
No, thank you.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're following that law where we have a short agenda, but we're filling the time with the work. So I hate to contribute to that, but I just have an overriding concern here, I guess. We've all spent our life volunteering. We wouldn't be here. I mean, we're all committed to service in our communities and back home in our district and private service and public service, and it's volunteers make the world go round. I was a Chamber of Commerce. I started out, you know, a dozen years as a Chamber of Commerce director, everything was run by volunteers. So I understand, and I do know that there's a decline in volunteerism across the board. You know, whether it's PTAs or, you know, you name it, it's hard to find volunteers. My concern is that, is the government really the best place to tackle this issue? I know in my community, Elder Circle and United Way and others have come together, and they have signs all over the community talking about volunteering, you know, just at the grassroots level, just kind of getting it out there and alerting people that of the opportunity. I can't quite see the fit with getting government involved in volunteerism. And you yourself mentioned the Wilder Foundation, and I'm thinking the Minnesota Council Foundations. Have you explored other conveners or other scenarios rather than coming to the state legislature?
Ms. Bugin?
Mr. Chair, my comment is that this is designed to bring everybody together. So there is 100% dollar for dollar match involved. We have to have other commitments. We include in this group leaders from community leaders because we want it to belong to the communities from the different sectors. So we mentioned the business community, we mentioned the government, we mentioned the nonprofit sector as being, we want representatives from all of those groups to be involved in this process. But we have had historically much more government money than we have now. As a matter of fact, in the Serve America Act, which funds AmeriCorps, but it also historically has funded Learn and Serve, which is service learning. Service learning was totally eliminated from the Corporation for National Service. Volunteerism, from what I could get from the Serve America Act when I had my last copy of it, $360 million was available for the whole country as authorization, but it was not appropriated. What has been appropriated is, and now it's up to about $6 million for the whole country, a little bit under $6 million, I believe, or that's what they're asking for now, and that's the highest amount. It was like $3 million or something when we started. So there has been a huge shift away, and we're seeing now that we're having a decline in volunteerism, especially the sustained volunteerism. But it's locally driven. It's locally, people select which indicators they want to work on, and there's just a whole slew of them. So I understand your concern, and that's why it's a board rather than a state agency. We designed it with a lot of the balance in that process considered.
Representative Lindwin, anything further?
Well, I guess you partially answered my question, and I appreciate that you have community members involved and there's places for them on the board. But I still have some level of discomfort with having government be the answer, especially when it comes to volunteerism. It's kind of disappointing to think that government has to intervene. So I guess it's more of a statement of concern than another question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and probably to the bill author. Starting in 1.8, it talks about establishing the board membership, and it seems to be a partisan board from the standpoint that you're going to have two members appointed by the majority of both bodies and one member by the minority. I'm wondering why it was set up that way.
Is the person who drafted
it? I believe the question was to the chair.
Sure. Yeah, this is a pretty standard arrangement for an advisory board set up by the state. Mr. Gehring, I think, could maybe speak to it in a little more detail.
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, right. So you can structure a board kind of however you'd like, and this was the model that I think worked best for the stakeholders in this bill, and this is what they preferred.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, and there are obviously Subdivision 2 has requirements as far as their experience, and so they are. It is a requirement that there be a range of subsectors of the nonprofit, public, and business volunteerism members, communities. There's a requirement for geographic balance. The community indicator regions must reflect Minnesota Compass or other subsequent programs that consider that. So, there is a requirement that they be qualified for the position and have experience in the volunteerism field.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can appreciate some past history in the way these things are formed, but if indeed we're looking at forming a statewide effort to coordinate volunteerism, I think might be something to be considered, that maybe the membership of the board should be truly bipartisan and bicameral, because we're doing something benevolent here. It shouldn't turn into a partisan effort, but indeed, when I see stuff like this, it can do that. Moving, Mr. Chair, and maybe most likely the bill author, who starting in 2.7, where it talks about members serving without compensation except, and then it goes to 2.10 and saying reimbursement that the member may receive in the ordinary course of employment or from another non-state source that is not a grant or applicant. What does that mean? I guess it sounds like there'd be some reimbursement toward these members of this board.
Mr. Chair? Chair? don't testify.
Ms. Vogel?
There is thinking behind that. Let me give you an example that perhaps that provides even a little different form of match. If someone is there, we have no money in here to pay any expenses of the members of this group. They're not being anybody who's appointed to this is not compensated by the state. However, let's say someone works for a big corporation, and that corporate and there are other examples too, but and that corporate person is being allowed to leave work to come to this committee, and they are not losing pay for that, as some corporations have policies like that, that's permissible. Or if a corporation wants to reimburse them for if they come someplace from someplace else for their mileage or something like that. That's what the intent is there. But it may also be some other employees, staff members, if they're on paid time, but they're being released to participate. Those would be examples. Or if somebody donates money, because there's a gift fund here, so that they would help to pay for food or something like that, that's permissible here.
Chair Freiber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Vogel for the question. This is actually to your last point, because you said kind of in your closing on that line of thought that you wanted it to be bipartisan and bicameral, and if you look to lines 1.10 to 1.13, it is by definition, because there are appointments by the Speaker of the House, the Minority Leader of the House, the President of the Senate, the Minority Leader of the Senate. So I just wanted that clarification to be in there too.
Representative Vogel?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just I was looking at the number and the disproportionate influence that are given the majority parties over the minority parties. The other thing I question as I read through this thing is the administrative cost. And there seems to be, when you get into subdivision 4 there, it says the commissioner administration must assist the board in entering into a contract for professional services for administrative support. Then when you get into 4.7, it says no more than 5% of a grant award may be used for administrative cost. And then when you get down into 4.26, it says no more than $70,000 each year, which is 12% of the $600,000, may be used to support administrative cost. Are they cumulative? Are they exclusive? It seems somewhat confusing on what controls, because my concern is always when something like this is started new, that the administrative costs start sucking up the benefit that should be going to the people that are actually supposed to be there to get the help.
Representative Freiberg or Ms. Buchan?
Chair, thank you. Actually, in the amendment, those lines on the 5% have been taken out. And that's because we want it to correspond to whatever is the Department of Administration is handling administrative expenses for what that is intended to be. That is intended to be when you give money to a grant to a grantee, how much money they can spend on administrative costs for implementing the grant. The $70,000 is for the overall work of the overall board. So they're separate things. One is it's going to cost money to gather the information, do the analysis, help with setting up a tracking system, things like that. Those are hypotheticals, but it will cost money to do that. It will take some staff time someplace. The 5% that was in there before is for the grantees. When you give out a grant, how much can they spend out of their grant on some admin costs to run the grant? And that there will be some standard amount, I would imagine, that the Department of Administration uses in their contracting. And that's why we put that, took that out of there.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So back to then the actual expense, the administrative expense that could be accrued at the state level. It says no more than $70,000 each year. Does that relate directly then back to 2.13 and 2.14? So basically we're saying that about 12% of the money is going to go to this outside contracted agency, and there isn't going to be anything else used at the state level for administration?
Yeah, that's what it was intended for, the contractor. And certainly if we need to refine that somehow, and I think others have more expertise than I do, but that's the intent, was the original intent.
Chair Freiberg. The $70,000 on line 4.26, if I'm understanding the question correctly, refers back to line 4.24, because it says of this amount as it's amended, but maybe Mr. Gehring can clarify that portion.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, so the $70,000 is a portion of the $600,000 that is appropriated here per year, so that Representative Freiberg described that correctly, and I agree with testifier that that $70,000 would be what would be used to support the contractor that the board would have to hire to conduct the work of the board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so I guess what I'm after then is basically we're going to use 12% of the money for hiring this contractor, but no other funds out of the whole $600,000 will be spent for any type of administration. Is that a correct assumption?
To the grantees.
Chair Freiberg is answering.
Yes, I'm getting a nod from Mr. Gehring.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? If not, is there any other business on this issue? Otherwise,
I guess I'll just, I think Representative Cagle, I appreciated your words and your experience working with volunteers. I don't think I could say any better than you did, so I will renew my motion that House File 2509 as amended be referred to the State Government Finance Division.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Yes. Mr. Chair, if you could, rather than me coming up there, I had a couple things I wanted to say to close out the meeting, if I could just do that.
I'll give you the floor.
Okay, thank you.
Motion prevailed and then last vote.
So. Okay, thank you for that motion prevailing. So first, we do have a new page. Yang, if you'd like to stand up. I should say not a new page, an additional page. So we have two great pages here. So look forward to you being with us over the course of the session. So thank you for being here. I did want to let members know about the schedule for next week also. So we will have meetings on Tuesday and Thursday. We're starting to get to the point where there are lots of bills getting referred from other committees to us, so that we will have full agendas most likely. I think with members' indulgence, it seems to work pretty well where we can go past our scheduled adjourn time of 11:15 to potentially 12 or 12:30. I think that might make it so that we don't need to come back in the evening on Tuesday and Thursday, although it is possible that we will also need to come back in the evening on Tuesday and Thursday. It is also possible we will need to meet on Friday. But stay tuned for details on those. But I did want to let you know we're starting. I'm surprised, actually, our agendas have been as small as they've been up until now. But I think starting next week, we'll start to see a lot more. So that was pretty much what I want to say. But I'm happy to respond to questions, too, if there are any.
So there being no other business or announcements, this meeting is adjourned.